Please, sir, I want some more.
More? From Chicago, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Ballgame. From the top of the wax to the bottom of the stacks, inappropriately rocking you all night long to the break of dawn, coming to you from the log cabin theme room of the Film Spotting Mansion, this is Film Spotting After Hours. This is where we need one of those howls, you know, that we can throw in maybe in post-production or something like that.
There's production?
Isn't there?
No.
Jack? Are we hot right now? Actually, I think it would be pretty fitting because this week on After Hours, it's our listener choice review of The Haunting, brought to you by Karen of beautiful Mason, Ohio. We'll get to that in a second. But first, we have some feedback. These are real emails. Some weeks ago, we rather sacrilegiously listed our top five characters in need of a comeback. And Andy Harriode of Oak Park, Illinois, that's, of course, Frank Lloyd Wright country, wrote in with an inspired choice of his own.
Yes, he did. Dear Adam and Maddie, the characters I really want to revisit are Wayne Campbell and his spectacled sidekick, Garth of the great Wayne's World films. Imagine it. It's 2008, and Wayne and Garth must face their greatest obstacle to date, middle age. Our heroes, now in their mid-40s, are devoted family men. They live in Naperville. Aurora, after all, has gone way too downhill to raise children in. With the metal scene of the mid to late 80s and early 90s all but dead, the two have now found themselves in the inevitable situation of being socially irrelevant. How I see it playing out is as a meditation on what happens when those who rejected authority the most have now given in, grown up, and themselves become authority figures to a new generation with their own zeitgeist. While I know it would never happen, a little part of me hopes that somehow Mike Myers gets a hold of this email and abandons this love guru nonsense. I think it's too late, Andy. Austin Powers got three movies. Why not Wayne?
Well, the fact of the matter is, I don't think it's going to take this email. I guarantee there's probably about two or four scripts out there in Hollywood.
Maybe
I'm
so.
Sure Dana Carvey probably wrote them, just hoping to get himself back onto the
Dusting
scene.
Dusting those off, yeah.
Exactly. All right, well, speaking of Wayne, Wayne Wilentz writes in from Gaithersburg, Maryland. His top five characters, I would have absolutely gone with Nick and Nora, number one, which I think made both of our list, right?
My honorable mention, I think.
Casting, how about Chris Eigeman as Nick and Lauren Graham as Nora? They had this cool, smart chemistry in Gilmore Girls. I have a teenage daughter, okay? That would be great for a Thin Man update. One other character I had in mind was Gasp Sherlock Holmes. Casting Matthew Good, Tom in Matchpoint as Holmes. Jim Broadbent, great choice as Watson, and of course Alan Rickman as Moriarty. I see a cameo of Anthony Hopkins in drag as Mrs. Hudson. Well, we also asked to those people up for the challenge to try and cast the characters we mentioned in our list with actors working today, and Mike from Parts Unknown weighed in with his picks.
That's right. Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China, he says, why not Emil Hirsch? Chauncey Gardner from Being There, your pick, Judah Friedlander. The young Ripley from Alien on my list, Gretchen Mol.
I'm not sure about that either.
The Thin Man, Nick and Nora, why not Zooey Deschanel and Cillian Murphy? Harmonica, my pick, which some people thought was blasphemy. Charles Bronson, of course, why not Crispin Glover?
Of course. He's dead on here. He's the only guy you could give this to.
Probably so. Mr. Tibbs, I wanted Virgil Tibbs back. Why not Mos Def as Fletch? Paul Rudd, I love that pick.
This is the best pick.
Yeah,
best pick.
Absolutely, Paul Rudd is brilliant there. You wanted Bullet. He says there are no male actors that fit the bill, so why not Zoe Bell?
This guy is inspired.
Death Proof.
Wayne, bringing the heat.
Absolutely.
I love it. All right, well, Brian Dexter, also from Parts Unknown, writes in, RoboCop, Murphy, is restarted after sitting for decades in an abandoned Detroit warehouse. Now the place we need indestructible cops is, of course, Iraq.
Why not?
Now with CGI, I'll buy it. Han Solo, the Kessel Run years, life as a smuggler on the run. How did he win the Millennium Falcon? I guarantee, I'm sure there's probably about five or six books that were on the New York Times bestseller that describes that exact scenario.
Yeah.
I love this pick. Second prize is a set of steak knives. Blake. Alec Baldwin returns as Blake, the salesman to avoid, above all others, of course, from Glengarry Glen Ross. What is life like in his office? What happens to the suckers he sells to, and what happens when one of them seeks revenge? Well, he kind of plays a variation on this on 30 Rock right now, but I guarantee, I'm sure they're going to do some sort of crossover with The Office.
I'd
Maybe. Love to see the Blake come in and clean house.
Yeah, that would be good. And I just want to briefly go back to the Mr. Tibbs pick. Virgil Tibbs, of course, from In the Heat of the Night, Mos Def. I'm sorry, Mos Def lately as an actor is doing nothing for me.
No.
And as I said to one listener, I wish I had the email here, he was like, wait a second, like you, Maddie, you just can't do it. Can't bring back Virgil Tibbs. And my response was five words. Chiwetel Ejiofor is Virgil Tibbs.
Nice.
I would pay, here's my $10. I would go see that. I think he would be perfect in that. I'd take him instead of Mos Def.
Well played, Mr.
Okay.
Campanar.
Well, let's go ahead and hear a voicemail here, Maddie, in reference to our review of the movie The Fall.
Hey, Maddie and Adam. This is Robert Holloway in the Bay Area. I had the good fortune to work over several years with Tarsem Singh. I was with Levi's in Europe, and he was making TV commercials for us. The guy is amazing. He would come dressed to meetings or dressed in Indian outfits to meetings and had a visual sense and style that I had never seen. And we worked with a lot of great film directors over a 10-year period. I can't wait to see The Fall. I really enjoyed your review. Thanks very much, and looking forward to the next podcast.
Robert there in the Bay Area had the pleasure of working with Tarsem. We did review The Fall recently. You liked it a little bit more than I did, but we were taken with some of the visual grandeur of it, and certainly the performance of the young girl there. It was a visual feast for the eyes, as we like to say, and we got this great email in response.
This is from Rakesh Barua from Brooklyn, New York. God, we are so big in Brooklyn.
We are.
But I don't know where in Brooklyn.
No,
I'm
you're right.
Bed-Stuy.
They need to be specific.
Gotta be really
they?
Specific. As usual, enjoyed this week's show. It's one of two things that get me through Monday, sitting in my lonesome cubicle. The other, of course, being the weekly podcast of that other Chicago contribution to public radio, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, one of my favorite shows. I particularly enjoyed the Tarsem review. As an Indian kid growing up in Milwaukee, I felt it was an ethnic obligation to support Tarsem Singh and see The Cell in the theater opening weekend to boost, of course, its box office stats. It was the first and one of the only times I've ever gone to a movie by myself. And as if sitting at the age of 16 in a dark theater while watching Vincent D'Onofrio slowly spool Vince Vaughn's intestines out of his stomach wasn't traumatizing enough, I saw it during the day and emerged from the black of the theater into a dizzying sunlight that only exacerbated how weird and unnatural the entire experience was. Thanks for the review, but I think I'll skip The Fall and continue to support my Indian director by giving 4-star reviews to REM's Losing My Religion video on YouTube instead.
And here I thought I was the only one. Well done. And this one we got from Jim in Seattle, his top 5 best dressed characters, another recent top 5 we had. What was that tying in with? Sex and the City, mm-hmm. I believe, was the tie-in there. He was extremely surprised that our top 5 best dressed list did not include a single mention of a costume designer. You almost sort of spoke about these actors as if they had walked onto the set already wearing the clothes they would be wearing on screen. They didn't? I realize that most listeners, including me, can't even name more than maybe 5 costume designers in total, but even a cursory mention of the fact that someone else's job was to dress these people would have been putting the credit in the right place. You two would never attribute a line in a movie to the actor who spoke it. Well, actually, we might. I mean, he didn't come up with it, but maybe he made it work.
We're not beyond
we'll
that.
Frequently even give the screenwriter credit. So why spend 5 minutes talking costumes and never once mention the people who envisioned, designed, and created those costumes? He's absolutely right.
Absolutely.
I mean, for shame.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's absolutely for shame. You know what it is, though? It's lack of time to prepare.
Yeah.
It really is. That, I mean, doing this show every week is such a time consumer that sometimes we just can't do that extra mile of looking those things
well,
up.
Well, luckily this week we got an intern on it, and voila. Adam, why don't you take your list?
Okay, here we go. I had Breakfast at Tiffany's, Audrey Hepburn. Apparently she didn't wear those outfits herself. Edith Head, the great Edith Head, designed those. She also designed the outfits in Rear Window for Jimmy Stewart and Lisa Carol Fremont. Grace Kelly, American Psycho, the costume designer was Isis Musenden. And in Bonnie and Clyde, Theodora Van Runkle, and The Untouchables, Marilyn Vance doing the costume design with, as we mentioned on a recent show, Giorgio Armani doing the wardrobe.
All right, well, I had Sabrina, of course, Edith Head, the great costume designer there. Pillow Talk, Bill Thomas did the costume design, but the great Jean-Louis responsible for the gowns that Miss Day wore. Ocean's 11, Jeffrey Kurland. Secretary, Marjorie Bowers, whose other claim to fame is that she did Coppola's Rumblefish in the early 80s. Munich, Joanna Johnston, and Slapshot, Tom Bronson. Great feedback as always. If you'd like to drop us a line with any thoughts about the show, send them to feedback@filmspotting.net. We can't guarantee they will be read on the air, but I can guarantee Adam will read them and obsess about them.
Well, what's going to happen? Why are we here?
Well, like so many other people through the ages, I've been intrigued by the supernatural, or rather the possibility of the supernatural. I'm here in hopes of proving its existence. You're here to keep track of what happens and take notes for an authenticated record.
Okay, but why us?
It's no accident. You're what's left of a select company chosen with great care. I combed the records of psychic societies, the back numbers of newspapers, the reports of parapsychologists, in the hope of finding people who've been touched in some way by the supernatural. It's my belief that the very presence of people like yourselves in this house will help to stimulate the strange forces at work here.
That was a clip from 1963's The Haunting. This is our listener's choice review. It was selected for us by Karen of Mason, Ohio. Adam, when people believed the Earth was flat, the idea of a round world scared them silly. Then they found out how the round world works. It's the same with the world of the supernatural. Until we know how it works, we'll continue to carry around this unnecessary burden of fear. So says Richard Johnson's Dr. Markway in 1963's The Haunting, directed, of course, by Robert Wise, based on Shirley Jackson's short story, The Haunting of Hill House. Adam, you and I are self-described fraidy cats. Here we get a film, in part because when it was made, relies on suspense rather than gore to scare the hell out of you. I've said it before, like Joey on Friends, really scary movies like really scary books, I need to stick them in the fridge to cool off. Is The Haunting, 1963's The Haunting, fridge-worthy?
I don't know if it's quite fridge-worthy. I might stick it in one of those styrofoam coolers for a little bit. But if you haven't seen The Haunting, and I want to quote here an email actually from Karen in Mason, Ohio, because she really says it a lot better than I could about why she picked this movie, why it means so much to her. She says, "It isn't a horror film as much as a psychological thriller anchored on an extremely compassionate questioning of what precisely is a ghost. It hinges on details of human unsettlings and works not so much at being frightening as exploring how fear amplifies all manner of perceptions. You never see the ghost. You never know if those who are stuck in the house see anything. You are left to make up your own mind while sleeping with all the lights on. Very Jamesian turn-of-the-screw ambiguity. When I was a kid," Karen writes, "we'd plan slumber parties around a television broadcast and wouldn't be able to get past the opening before freaking ourselves out. It was then considered the scariest film of its genre in existence. In college, I attended an open viewing with pretty jaded slasher film buffs in the audience. It was the only time I heard an entire audience scream. You'll know the scene. In my opinion, it holds up better than The Exorcist." Well, very well said, Karen. And it didn't scare me as much as The Exorcist still does scare me. And like I said, maybe not completely fridge-worthy because it only scared me 3 or 4 times, but I was creeped out for most of the movie, and I absolutely do know which scene Karen's referring to.
Yes.
It's the one that almost made me jump off my couch and made me feel like an incredible loser in front of my wife who was sitting next to me. So I know what she's talking about. It really does rely on that suspense and not gore, as you mentioned, and it's all psychological.
It
really is. We don't see the ghost. She's absolutely right. It's all in their heads, perhaps. It's all in our heads about what is really going on outside that door knocking, and it's effective.
Yeah, it really is, and I think it's the photography here, Wise's photography, that really makes the film. I mean, it's so atmospheric, you know? And yes, of course, the house becomes a character.
Yes.
And I think the only time that the suspense is really undermined for me is the voiceover of Julie Harris when we're inside her head, because it's really unneeded. We don't need to know what she's thinking. This film is all about the unknown, the unseen, giving us access to her thoughts. It's just not as effective as watching her and the others. And there's, you know, these four really interesting, sort of creepy people. There's just something off about each one of these characters reacting to this house.
No, I agree with you there. And I do want to give a lot of the credit to Robert Wise, the director, because like with West Side Story and The Andromeda Strain and Star Trek, the motion picture, I've commented on this before, he just has a great sense of production design. And I don't, unfortunately, have the production designer's name. I did actually look it up for this film, but it wasn't the same one that he worked with on other movies. I was hoping there was a connection. But there is this clear emphasis on that production design, where here it's impeccable. And the house, you said it, is a character literally, but figuratively as well. We start to pay so much attention to what's going on in the house and what the frame is showing us just outside of the characters, behind them, around them. I think actually studying the house and the rooms and all those crazy angles is more interesting than any of those people. Even though the people themselves are pretty interesting, I think the house is the best character.
Claire Bloom as the psychic, I think she's great, but I just
kinda
wish
wasted.
She was given more to do. I don't know quite why she's there.
No, I don't either. Claire Bloom, a.k.a. my new movie crush, you mean, Claire Bloom? and of course Richard Johnson, aka the English Tom Selleck.
Very nice.
He has to be the English Tom Selleck. I kind of liked him too, though.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think ghosts actually tell you more about the people who believe in them than, of course, ghosts themselves. I actually believe in ghosts. I have a couple ghost stories, which I won't share here lest I am held to your ridicule. But this is Eleanor's story. This is Julie Harris, and she is becoming consumed by this house. I mean, she's basically the shut-in who's forced to care for her mother for years. She is guilty about her mother's death. It's the first time she's shown any attention at all. And of course, she immediately falls in love with the English Tom Selleck, mm-hmm. and ultimately is driven mad by that love mm-hmm. that goes unrequited. So yes, it's the house, but again, it's her, and it really centers around her and her deterioration.
Yes.
You know, I mean, because the house, unlike the fall of Usher, isn't going to come down. It's the people that are going to enter into it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And going back to Wise just for a second, I mean, the way he shoots this film, the variety of camera angles, the way the camera sometimes will follow those characters mm-hmm. walking up that rounding staircase head on. It's almost like what we see from Spike Lee, right? Those shots where he likes to put the camera head on someone. We get this back here in The Haunting. It's really effective. There's just a heightened effect to everything in this film, and it's all mood, and it really is creepy. So I got to give Robert Wise, the director and the production designer and set people, a lot of credit here. For me, you kind of touch on this. I do think that Julie Harris as Eleanor started to wear on me mm-hmm. a little bit. I never completely followed her breakdown in terms of wanting to stay at the house. The actions all vaguely make sense if you buy into this idea that she's connected to this house from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Somehow she's meant to be here. If you buy into that, it all kind of makes sense. But I'm not sure. Her actions, the dancing and everything.
It's because they keep feeding her these myths. Right. So she's going to latch onto it. I mean, she knows no other reality other than her living room playing Parcheesi for the past 30 years. You know, she comes out and she's like excited by the ability to be around these other people and this sort of otherworldly mythology. She latches onto that.
That's true.
You know, she can't handle it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. For me, another thing I really liked about it, I mean, anyone who has taken English 101 knows Shirley Jackson from The Lottery, one of the all-time great short stories. But there really is a connection here to this story, which, from what I understand, the movie is pretty faithful to the short story. But it's this whole thing going on with the modern world, not only versus the supernatural world, but versus the old world, these kind of old values and old way of doing things. You have in The Lottery that very clear case of that where it's the present day, but they're partaking in this ancient ritual. And that's where the horror and the tension comes from, is that present day modern world meeting the old world. And here in this film, I mean, what do you make about the fact that there's this very clear moment, right, where Eleanor calls Theo a lesbian?
Yeah.
She calls her. Yeah. I mean, it's very clear that she's attracted to her. There's something about this whole dynamic going on that is freaking her out. And Theo is kind of coming on to her in moments. And the fact that they call her Theo, mm-hmm. right, instead of her full name, Theodora. But that's really interesting. She calls her unnatural. She accuses her of being unnatural. And you know, that one moment where she says something about, do you have a husband? And it's like, no, you know, I mean, come on. And so it's just very interesting that that whole dynamic is there. But you do have with this house, with the Hill House, that meshing of the old world and the new world colliding. And that's something I based on The Lottery in a way that Shirley Jackson obviously was interested in, and it's really effective here too.
Well, you have the great Russ Tamblyn, of course, coming in as sort of the young punk who actually owns the house
now. Dr. Jacoby.
Yeah, wants to get rid of him. Dr. Jacoby, of course, people would know from
and Riff.
Yeah, exactly, from West Side Story. And I'm kind of with you. I think the last act, while it gives us the most suspense, mm-hmm. it's also when I started to lose perspective just a little bit. Almost too many crazy angles, one too many for me. I was like, okay, where's my head at? Where's her head at?
Yeah.
And we also get the introduction of a new character, of course. And that's a whole last third act. I think they could have been a little bit more suspense, a little bit more tightening there.
Mm-hmm.
Great choice for Karen. Thank you so much for picking that one for us. Now, reminder, if you'd like to hear us review a movie of your choice, all you need to do is donate to Film Spotting. You can find out how on the Film Spotting webpage, filmspotting.net. For every $10 you donate to the show, not only do you keep Film Spotting on the air, your name gets entered into the Film Spotting hat. We pick a winner, and you get to choose a movie for us to review. It's just that simple.
It is that simple, and we want to spell out that these winners were chosen from the names that came in, the donors from between, I think, episode 210 and 213. So if your name was mentioned on the show where we reviewed The Happening and The Hulk, you're going to be included in that next batch of winners we pick out. But right now, we do have another winner to announce, and he is Peter from Seattle, Washington. Peter Durkee, I believe, is his last name. You're up next in Listener's Choice, our next episode of After Hours. You send us three movies you would like to hear us discuss. Feedback@filmspotting.net. Maddie and I are going to pick one of those and talk about it on the next episode.
Sounds great. And so if you'd like to donate, go to the webpage. And actually, there's all kinds of cool things you can do with the website. We don't mention this a lot. You can vote in polls. You can check out our star ratings.
Yes.
I think a lot of people are sort of surprised that we offer those.
Yeah.
And we even have message boards.
Oh, message boards.
I know, Adam, you, of course, you hang out there.
I do.
Your Marla Thomas avatar is to die for.
Marla Thomas.
Because I don't even know what an avatar is.
No, you don't.
Word a day calendars. But anyway, so go check it out if you're so inclined.
Yeah. And also, I want to mention something. This is going to sound totally shameless, but I really mean it. I, for the first time, we're always pushing. We haven't for a while, but we like to push the Film Spotting merchandise, get a Film Spotting t-shirt or whatever.
The swag shop.
I finally bought some Film Spotting merchandise. We've been pushing it on the show. I finally got my box of Film Spotting merchandise. I got a t-shirt. I got a t-shirt for my wife. I got my Film Spotting coffee mug that I drink out of every day and look like a big dork, but it's great. And I just want to say thanks to Frank out there in Australia who designed those for us. I'm sorry, the t-shirt is really cool.
Cool.
I think it's really cool. I'm really happy with it. Maddie, yours is on the way. So I do hope people, if you're fans of the show, you want to check out a t-shirt. I just want to say that I was impressed with the quality of them. I like it.
And if you do buy one, send us a picture of yourself in that t-shirt. We'd love to see it.
We would love to see that.
All right. Well, for Film Spotting After Hours, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thank you for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.